This is Medieval Death Trip for Thursday, October 31st, 2024, episode 110, concerning the Green Children of Woolpit and other prodigies. Hello and welcome to Medieval Death Trip, the show where we explore the wit and weirdness of medieval texts. I'm your host, Patrick Lane. It was on a Halloween night, much like this one, 10 long years ago, that something peculiar first made itself known. A voice without a body carried across the ether. That strange manifestation was this show. That's right, this is our 10th anniversary episode on number 110. To mark this milestone, it seemed appropriate to look at one of the most famous bits of medieval weird history, the Green Children of Woolpit. This story has been told and retold many times in many forms, including quite a few podcasts, but also novels, plays, and even a 1990 opera by Nicolas Lefanu. That does make it a bit daunting to approach, but we'll do what we do on this show and go to the medieval texts themselves and encounter this story in its original context. As many times as it has been retold by later writers, it originates, in written form at least, in really just two medieval authors, Ralph of Cogshall and William of Newburgh. William is no newcomer to this show. He was featured on our second Halloween anniversary episode, episode 31, concerning the revenants of William of Newburgh. Both Ralph and William present remarkably similar accounts, though with practically no identical wording, so it doesn't seem that it's likely one is copying directly from the other. Most likely, they are both recording their own rendition of an oral tradition. Or, tradition is a bit strong. Allegedly, this story wasn't passed down over generations. Ralph claims to have heard it directly from one of the key characters involved, and William isn't as specific, but claims he got it from very credible sources. Now, it wasn't a fresh story. It was two or three decades old by the time Ralph and William were writing it down, but it was something understood to have happened in living memory. It's not a legend from the distant past where one would expect details to warp and metaphorical imagery to perhaps get transmuted into literal details. That said, we do know from the examples of urban legends that 20 years is more than enough time for either a true story to fictionalize in transmission or for pure fiction to acquire the facade of true story. And even though the witnesses for urban legends are often a friend of a friend or maybe a daughter's friend's mother, it's still not uncommon, even in our heavily documented age, for a person to put themselves into an urban legend, and memory being what it is, even that person can, over years, come to believe that their version of the story really happened to them. But against that skepticism towards a decidedly strange tale, we do have the strong correlation between Ralph and William's seemingly independent accounts. And there's also just something about the kind of detail this story has that makes it feel real in a way that a lot of other legendary material doesn't. So it isn't surprising that most of the discourse surrounding the Green Children since the Middle Ages has been earnest attempts to explain them and to discern what must have really happened in Woolpit in the mid-1100s. We'll touch on some of the theories proffered to make sense of the Green Children later, but first, let's hear Exhibit A from the medieval evidence, the version told by Ralph of Cogshall. The story appears in the Chronicon Anglicanum, a chronicle that had been begun by other monks at Cogshall Abbey in Essex, but which Ralph took on the responsibility of continuing after resigning as abbot of Cogshall due to poor health. He's writing in the 1220s, which is a couple of decades later even than William of Newburgh, but he is much closer to the scene of the story. Cogshall Abbey is only about 26 miles south of Woolpit, and it's perfectly plausible that Cogshall's abbot would be having conversations with members of some of the leading families in the region from whom he says he heard this story. But we aren't starting directly with the Green Children, because Ralph is prompted to tell that story by another story. So we'll begin with the preceding narrative, one much less discussed, and one less weird, but still pretty weird. While there are plenty of translations just of Ralph's version of the story of the Green Children floating around out there as part of the larger Green Children myth-making and myth-busting discourse, the rest of Ralph does not have a modern English translation. And since I wanted to give you the Green Children as they were embedded in Ralph's larger work, I had to make a fresh translation for this show. And once again, this process was machine-assisted, as with last episode's text, a combination of ChatGPT and Google Translate with pretty careful line-by-line auditing by me. But, to be frank, the bulk of this is ChatGPT's output, and it only required some light revision, and even there, it was more issues of minor word choice preferences rather than significant errors in accuracy. In fact, I would say this translation is markedly more accurate than one of the most commonly reprinted and quoted translations out there, one by 19th century folklorist Thomas Keightley in the second edition of his book, The Fairy Mythology, from 1850, which omits whole clauses here and there. So, here is a new translation of four unnumbered chapters of Ralph of Coggeshall's Chronicon Anglicanum from the Latin text edited by Joseph Stevenson. About a certain wild man caught in the sea. In the time of King Henry II, when Bartholomew de Glanville was overseeing the castle at Orford, it happened that some fishermen, while fishing in the sea nearby, caught a wild man in their nets. They handed him over to the aforementioned castellan, who marveled at the sight. He was entirely naked, but resembled a human in all his limbs. He had hair on his head, though it appeared to be thinned and unevenly spread, and his beard was long and pointed. His chest was excessively hairy and rough. The aforementioned knight had him kept under guard day and night to prevent him from reaching the sea. He eagerly ate whatever was given to him, consuming fish both raw and cooked. However, he would squeeze the raw fish tightly in his hands until all the moisture was drained out before he ate it. He did not speak at all, either unwilling or perhaps unable to do so, even when he was suspended by his feet and subjected to harsh torture. When taken to the church, he showed no sign of reverence or belief, neither by kneeling nor by bowing his head when he saw anything sacred. Each evening, he would hurry to his sleeping place at sunset and remain there until sunrise. On one occasion, they brought him to the seashore and released him into the water, setting up strong nets in three layers ahead of him. He immediately dove to the bottom of the sea and passed through all the nets. Again and again he would surface from the depths, looking at the people watching from the shore, diving repeatedly and then resurfacing, almost mocking them for his escape from their nets. After playing in the sea for a long time like this, and when all hope of his return had been abandoned, he swam back to them voluntarily through the waves and stayed with them for another 2 months. Later, however, as his captors grew negligent in guarding him and he was regarded as more of a nuisance, he secretly fled back to the sea and was never seen again. Whether he was a mortal man, a fish assuming human form, or some malevolent spirit inhabiting the body of a drowned man, as is recounted in the life of St. Aldwyn, is difficult to determine, especially since many strange stories are told by many people of such events. Concerning a certain boy and girl emerging from the earth. Another marvel, similar to the former one, occurred in Suffolk at St. Mary of Woolpit. A certain boy was found with his sister by the residents of that place near the edge of a certain pit which is located there. They had the appearance of other people in all their bodily members, but they differed from all mortals of our inhabited world in the color of their skin. For the entire surface of their skin was tinged with a green color. No one could understand their speech. They were brought, out of amazement, to the house of a certain knight, Sir Richard de Conn, at Wykes. There, they wept inconsolably. Bread and other foods were set before them, but they refused to eat any of the food that was offered to them, despite being tormented by great hunger for a long time. They believed all such foods to be inedible, as the girl later confessed. At last, when freshly harvested beans, still with their stalks, were brought into the house, they eagerly gestured for some of these beans to be given to them. When the beans were brought before them, they opened the stalks, not the pods of the beans, thinking that the beans were contained within the hollows of the stalks. But when they did not find any beans in the stalks, they began to weep again. When the bystanders realized this, they opened the pods and showed them the beans. Upon seeing them, they ate the beans with great delight, not touching any other food for a long time. The boy, as if always weighed down by illness, died within a short time. The girl, enjoying continued good health, gradually became accustomed to eating a variety of foods, and she completely lost her green color, eventually regaining a healthy reddish complexion throughout her body. Afterward, she was baptized and lived for many years in the service of the aforementioned knight, as we have often heard from the knight himself and his family. She became rather wild and unruly. When frequently questioned about the people of her country, she asserted that all the inhabitants and everything in that region were tinged with green, and that they never saw the sun, but enjoyed a certain kind of light like that which occurs after sunset. When asked how she and the boy had come to this land, she said that while they were following their livestock, they entered a certain cave. As they ventured in, they heard the pleasant sound of bells. Captivated by the sweetness of this sound, they wandered through the cave for a long time until they finally emerged from it. Upon emerging, they were struck dumb by the intense brightness of the sun and the unfamiliar air, and they lay dazed at the edge of the cave for a long time. When they were frightened by the disturbance of those who came upon them, they tried to flee, but they could not find the entrance to the cave again, and so they were captured. Of the Teeth of Giants. In the time of King Richard, two teeth of a certain giant were found on the shore of the sea in a village called Edolf's Ness. These teeth were so large that 200 human teeth of the present day could be carved out of them. We both saw and marveled at these teeth at Cogshall. Also found there was a rib of the same giant, of incredible size and width. In the province of York, a giant's skull was discovered on the shore of the sea, with a skull cap large enough to hold a bushel of grain. All of these findings confirm the truth of what ancient histories say about the bodies of giants. Some of our people in Wales also saw a young man of immense stature, whose height was 5 cubits, 10.5 feet, or 3.2 meters. The length and thickness of his fingers were extraordinary, but he was deprived of his strength in youth by some misfortune. In the same province in that same year, unusual human footprints of great length appeared in a certain grassy plain, and wherever the footprints were impressed, the grass remained as if scorched by fire. Of a certain phantom spirit. In the time of King Richard, in Dagworth, Suffolk, a certain phantom spirit often appeared and lingered for a long time in the house of Sir Osborne of Bradwell. It spoke with the household of the said knight, imitating the voice of a one-year-old child, and called itself Malkin. It claimed that its mother and brother lived in a nearby house, and that they frequently scolded it for leaving them and daring to speak with people. It would say and do strange and amusing things, sometimes revealing the secret actions of others. At first, the knight's wife and the whole household were greatly terrified by its conversations, but later, growing accustomed to its words and amusing actions, they began to speak with it confidently and familiarly, asking it many things. It spoke English in the local dialect, but sometimes also in Latin, and it discussed the scriptures with the knight's chaplain, as he himself truthfully testified to us. It could be heard and felt, but never seen, except once, when a certain girl saw it in the bedroom in the form of a very small child dressed in a white tunic. This happened after the girl had repeatedly begged and sworn to it that she would not touch it or hold it if it showed itself to her. The spirit also confessed that it had been born in Lavenham, and that while its mother was carrying it to the field where she was harvesting with others, she left it alone in part of the field. It was then abducted and taken away by another, and it had now been living with that same one for 7 years. It said that after another 7 years, it would return to live among people again. It claimed to use a certain cloak that rendered it and others invisible. It often demanded food and drink from those present, which, once placed on a certain chest, could no longer be found. So, there you have Ralph of Cogshall's account of the Green Children of Woolpit, amongst other wonders and prodigies. And that's what I want to start with. Let's take a quick look at those other items, then we'll hear William of Newburgh's version of the Green Children, and after that we can dig into that story more specifically. The seemingly obvious framework here would be to try to argue that when you aren't looking at it in isolation, when you see it in its natural habitat, so to speak, the Green Children story just becomes one in a list of improbable legends and folklore motifs, and it suddenly loses some of that luster of real historical event that it carries off better on its own. And I think that's a little bit true, and it will be far more true for William of Newburgh's positioning of the story. But actually, Ralph's other stories here are mostly not that improbable. They're a bit wild, but they don't feel that folkloric or legendary. The first story he shares I have seen described by other scholars as the capture of a merman, which is giving it more fantastical credit than it's due. Because if you boil it down, some fishermen capture a man swimming in the ocean who seemingly lived a hermit's life and either couldn't or chose not to speak with them. He's shown to be a good swimmer, but not supernaturally good. He's a bit odd-looking, and his lifestyle is unconventional, but nothing about him is inhuman. The namesake of this show, the book Wisconsin Death Trip, includes a few Victorian newspaper articles about so-called wild men being found in the forests of the upper Midwest. And these aren't Bigfoot, they are just people, likely with some degree of mental illness, who are living rough in the woods and are not always capable of communicating with the people who captured them. There's no real reason to doubt the veracity of those stories, and it makes sense that similar things would happen in the Middle Ages. And this really looks like one of them. Certainly, if you wanted to read this whole series of anecdotes as Ralph's digression on fairy lore, adding giants in there, then you could find the echoes of Selkie tales in this little story, but it feels like a stretch that even Ralph seems fairly skeptical of in his rundown of interpretive possibilities. Is he a man, a transformed fish, or, and here we have a fun connection to William of Newburgh, a demonically possessed corpse, which is one of the rationales for what animates revenants that we talked about back in William's episode 31. But Occam's razor seems to apply here and makes the simply a man possibility the most compelling. Moving on to the giant's teeth, the nicely specific setting of this story that Ralph gives us points us directly to a pretty compelling explanation. Edolf's Ness in Essex, the location where Ralph says the giant's teeth were found, is now the site of the town of Walton-on-the-Naze. Naze and Ness are two forms of the same word, meaning promontory or headland. There's a lot less of that headland now than there used to be. The medieval settlement of Walton and Edolf's Nest is now 9 miles out to sea and under the waves, the land having been lost to coastal erosion over the centuries. One side effect of continual erosion of coastal cliffs is that it tends to expose the fossils preserved in the London Clay Formation that stretches across the southeast of England. Indeed, Walton-on-the-Naze is cited today as one of the best places to go fossil hunting in Essex. And one kind of fossil commonly found there? Shark's teeth, including megalodon teeth as big as the palm of your hand. So, we could go through some of the usual rigmarole. Were there ever any actual giant's teeth, or is this just another tall tale? We should be cautious about taking any of these anecdotal marvels as having any basis in a real event. But this is just fossils, right? That seems like an overwhelmingly obvious and safe conclusion. Some medieval people found fossil teeth from prehistoric megafauna and assumed they came from biblical giants. I'm happy to say, case closed on this one, without any hand-wringing. Now, The final story of the mischievous invisible boy, I don't know what to do with. It is the one that feels the least real, but it has historical parallels in various reports of poltergeist phenomena. And you don't have to believe in ghosts to accept any of that, because it also resembles some famous household hauntings that are now widely accepted to have been pretty effective hoaxes, such as the Fox Sisters, or the modern case that this is uncannily similar to, Jeff the Talking Mongoose on the Isle of Man. If you're curious about either of those stories, there are countless other paranormal podcasts that will give you hours on each. The one thing I'll note is an interesting word choice. The Latin text refers to the invisible entity as a fantasticus spiritus, which ChatGPT rendered as phantom spirit. The common meaning of fantasticus in the standard Latin dictionaries, without really any variation, is imaginary. It is fantasy, a thing you conjure up in your mind. That's the normal usage. I'm not exactly sure how Ralph is using it here. It's perhaps as ambiguous as the entity itself. He may be reaching more for the sense of phantasma, which had been used to mean both an illusion, something not really there, but also a ghost and an apparition. So phantom seems to be a pretty canny choice by ChatGPT to translate this idea. Google Translate, by the way, opts for fantastic spirit, which just doesn't work in the modern English idiom. One place where I think ChatGPT was a little overzealous in its translation is in describing the abduction of this entity. It originally wrote, before my revisions, quote, "It was then abducted and taken away by another being, and had now been living with that being for 7 years," end quote. The original Latin hides any specificity about what this other was. It is just alia, an other. The later line about spending 7 years with this other before being allowed to live among people, ad hominem, certainly suggests that the other that took the child is not a person, but who knows? The entity contradicts itself anyway, saying at one point that it lives with its mother and brother in a nearby house, but then later claims it was stolen away from its mother. Maybe it's a Coraline other mother type situation, but it's a mess. And as I said, it really feels like the kind of improv prank that starts to run away with itself that you see in the history of the Fox Sisters and Jeff the Mongoose. Oh, and nobody tell Jeff that I've called him a hoax, just for my peace of mind. All right, let's get to our second version of the Green Children tale from William of Newburgh's Historia Rerum Anglicarum. William's is the earliest version of the story, written down around 1198, 20 years before Ralph, but at a much further distance in space. He is writing in Yorkshire, about 200 miles away from Woolpit. This does testify to how widely the story traveled, and again is a point in the looks like a true story column for this tale, since it seems to have exploded across the country by sheer word of mouth without major alteration to its details. That said, we do only have the two written sources from this period, and perhaps the monastic gossip pipeline was a much smaller world than we might imagine. William says lots of people were telling this story, but maybe that's a few monks heard it at Bury St. Edmunds or Cogshall from the same personalities that Ralph heard it from, and it's a good after-dinner story, and so at their next stop up at William's Priory, they repeat the story, and it's less an urban legend that all of England knows than it is a little narrative nugget a dozen monks have passed on to each other. But I'll let you judge for yourself. William's version is very similar to Ralph's, but there are a few interesting differences in details. So here it is, as translated by Joseph Stevenson. Chapter 27 of The Green Children. Nor does it seem right to pass over an unheard-of prodigy, which, as is well known, took place in England during the reign of King Stephen. Though it is asserted by many, yet I have long been in doubt concerning the matter, and deemed it ridiculous to give credit to a circumstance supported on no rational foundation, or at least one of a very mysterious character. Yet, At length, I was so overwhelmed by the weight of so many and such competent witnesses that I have been compelled to believe and wonder over a matter which I was unable to comprehend or unravel by any powers of intellect. In East Anglia, there is a village, distant, as it is said, 4 or 5 miles from the noble monastery of the blessed King and Martyr Edmund. Near this place are seen some very ancient cavities called wolf pits, that is, in English, pits for wolves, and which give their name to the adjacent village. During harvest, while the reapers were employed in gathering the produce of the fields, 2 children, a boy and a girl, completely green in their persons, and clad in garments of a strange color and unknown materials, emerged from these excavations. While wandering through the fields in astonishment, they were seized by the reapers and conducted to the village, and many persons coming to see so novel a sight, they were kept some days without food. But when they were nearly exhausted with hunger, and yet could relish no species of support which was offered to them, it happened that some beans were brought in from the field, which they immediately seized with avidity, and examined the stalk for the pulse, but not finding it in the hollow of the stalk, they wept bitterly. Upon this, one of the bystanders, taking the beans from the pods, offered them to the children, who seized them directly and ate them with pleasure. By this food they were supported for many months until they learnt the use of bread. At length, by degrees, they changed their original color through the natural effect of our food and became like ourselves and also learnt our language. It seemed fitting to certain discreet persons that they should receive the sacrament of baptism, which was administered accordingly. The boy, who appeared to be the younger, surviving his baptism but a little time, died prematurely. His sister, however, continued in good health, and differed not in the least from the women of our own country. Afterwards, as it is reported, she was married at Lynn, and was living a few years since, at least so they say. Moreover, after they had acquired our language, on being asked who and whence they were, they are said to have replied, "We are inhabitants of the land of St. Martin, who is regarded with peculiar veneration in the country which gave us birth." Being further asked where that land was and how they came thence hither, they answered, "We are ignorant of both those circumstances. We only remember this, that on a certain day, when we were feeding our father's flocks in the fields, we heard a great sound, such as we are now accustomed to hear at St. Edmund's when the bells are chiming. And whilst listening to the sound in admiration, we became on a sudden, as it were, entranced, and found ourselves among you in the fields where you were reaping." Being questioned whether in that land they believed in Christ, or whether the sun arose, they replied that the country was Christian and possessed churches. But said they, "The sun does not rise upon our countrymen. Our land is little cheered by its beams. We are contented with that twilight which among you precedes sunrise or follows the sunset. Moreover, a certain luminous country is seen, not far distant from ours, and divided from it by a very considerable river." These and many other matters, too numerous to particularize, they are said to have recounted to curious inquirers. Let everyone say as he pleases, and reason on such matters according to his abilities. I feel no regret at having recorded an event so prodigious and miraculous. Chapter 28. Of Certain Prodigies. Some other wonderful and astonishing occurrences have happened in our times, of which I shall mention a few. I call things of this nature wonderful, not merely on account of their rarity, but because some latent meaning is attached to them. On splitting a vast rock with wedges in a certain quarry, there appeared 2 dogs, but without any spiracle whatever, filling up the cavity of the rock which contained them. They seemed of that species which are called harriers, but of fierce countenance, disagreeable smell, and without hair. They report that one of them soon died, but that the other, having a most ravenous appetite, was for many days fondled by Henry, Bishop of Winchester. Again, it is related that in another quarry, while they were digging very deep for materials for building, there was found a beautiful double stone. That is, a stone composed of two stones, joined with some very adhesive matter. Being shown by the wondering workmen to the bishop who was at hand, it was ordered to be split, that its mystery, if any, might be developed. In the cavity, a little reptile, called a toad, having a small golden chain around its neck, was discovered. When the bystanders were lost in amazement at such an unusual occurrence, the bishop ordered the stone to be closed again, thrown into the quarry, and covered up with rubbish forever. In the province of the Diary also, not far from the place of my nativity, an extraordinary event occurred, which I have known from my childhood. There is a village, some miles distant from the Eastern Ocean, near which those famous waters, called the Gypsy, spring from the ground at various sources, not constantly indeed, but every alternate year, and, forming a considerable current, glide over the lowlands into the sea. It is a good sign when these streams are dried up, for their flowing is said unquestionably to portend the disaster of a future scarcity. A certain rustic belonging to the village, going to see his friend who resided in the neighboring hamlet, was returning, a little intoxicated, late at night, when, behold, he heard, as it were, the voice of singing and reveling on an adjacent hillock, which I have often seen, and which is distant from the village only a few furlongs. Wondering who could be thus disturbing the silence of midnight with noisy mirth, he was anxious to investigate the matter more closely, and perceiving in the side of the hill an open door, he approached, and looking in, he beheld a house, spacious and lighted up, filled with men and women who were seated, as it were, at a solemn banquet. One of the attendants, perceiving him standing at the door, offered him a cup. Accepting it, he wisely forbore to drink, but, pouring out the contents and retaining the vessel, he quickly departed. A tumult arose among the company on account of the stolen cup, and the guests pursued him, but he escaped by the fleetness of his steed and reached the village with his extraordinary prize. It was a vessel of an unknown material, unusual color, and strange form. It was offered as a great present to Henry the Elder, King of England, and then handed over to the Queen's brother, David, King of Scotland, and deposited for many years among the treasures of his kingdom. And, a few years since, as we have learnt from authentic relation, it was given up by William, King of the Scots, to Henry II, on his desiring to see it. These and similar matters would appear beyond belief were they not proved to have taken place by credible witnesses. But if the magicians, as it is written, were able by Egyptian incantations and some secret cooperation of evil angels to turn rods into serpents and water into blood and to produce newly formed frogs, yet, as saith Augustine, we do not call these magicians the actual creators either of serpents or frogs, as husbandmen are not the makers of their harvests, for it is one thing to form and produce a creature from the farthest and remotest link in the chain of causes, which he who does is God the sole creator, and another from means and powers furnished by him to superinduce a second operation, that at such a time or in such a manner what is created shall have such an effect, which not only evil angels but also evil men are able to do. If, I say, by the permission of God, evil angels had this power, by means of magicians, it is not wonderful that they were able, by some power of angelic nature, more especially when allowed by a superior power, to make those exhibitions in question, partly by illusion and magic, as in the case of the nocturnal revel on the hill, partly in reality, as of the dogs, or the toad with the golden chain, or the cup, by which men may be held in blind amazement, and evil angels, when permitted, readily do those things, whereby men may be more dangerously deceived. Indeed, the nature of those green children who sprang from the earth is too abstruse for the weakness of our abilities to fathom. Thank you. So, there you have William's tale of the mysterious green children, wedded rather closely to a more traditional fairy story, albeit one that, for William, is confirmed by the real existence of this strange cup that passed into the hands of very real kings. And it doesn't hurt that it's a story from a very real place that William says he knew well from childhood. William's presentation is interesting, in that he really hedges the Green Children story, saying he himself really wouldn't believe it if it weren't for so many credible people telling it. He basically says, even as a medieval person who includes many a ghost story in his history, that the Green Children stretch the bounds of what's believable. Not only that, they stretch the bounds of what is explainable. His theological explanation for how people can seemingly perform magic gets a bit tangled up in its own syntax there at the end, but he seems quite prepared, as he was with the Revenants, to say, of course evil spirits can create illusions of things that aren't really here. They can even create real objects, like the cup, not out of nothing, but through a natural yet obscured chain of cause and effect, and all of this only through God's permission as he pursues his own purposes in testing human faith. And for William, boom, this explains the party in the fairy mound and where the unearthly cup came from. But he hesitates to determine to what degree this explains the appearance of the green children. They seem to be a kind of pure prodigy, one that isn't an evil illusion designed to deceive or an omen with a meaning to be interpreted, but simply a thing to be marveled at. Needless to say, later writers have not been content to merely marvel, but have done their darndest to wrench a convincing explanation out of the collection of Ralph and William's compelling, yet ultimately rather scanty details. A lot of my information here comes from a pair of articles by John Clark, former curator of the medieval collection at the Museum of London. He's primarily surveying the various treatments of the Green Children story, mostly with an eye towards pointing out how the medieval texts get a bit warped and abused to best suit whatever theory the writer wants to assert. But what are some of the main theories? I'm not going to try to be exhaustive here. This would be a very long episode to try to dive into all the ways the various details of the stories have been interpreted and all the different problems with individual theories and readings. But I'll try to lay out the broad contours of the landscape and then dig a few specific holes here and there to investigate deeper. So, first interpretation, and the one that Clark indicates has gained ground in academic discussions of the Green Children of late, this is that they are essentially fairy children, and that the story is a fairy tale. That is, it's folklore, not history. This was the viewpoint I was channeling earlier with seeing how our medieval authors position this anecdote amidst other marvels with differing levels of verisimilitude. That's not to say the general consensus is that the story is entirely fictional and has no real originating incident, but rather that the quest to reconstruct that incident is futile, and whatever it was, folkloric motifs have completely overgrown it, like the vegetation in the Green Knight's chapel. Then, of course, mainly looking back a century or so, there are those believers in the reality of the Fae who take the fairy explanation as a plausible one. The sibling theory to that simply crosses out fairies and writes in aliens, be they from outer space or hollow earth or other dimensions. Certainly, if you're looking for a medieval example of modern UFO and abduction tropes, this story gives you a moderately rich vein to tap. Interestingly, one current proponent of this approach, Scottish astronomer and science fiction author Duncan Lunan, has also apparently done quite a lot of basic records research to try to track down documentation of the Green Girl, and claims to have identified her as one Agnes, who appears kind of out of nowhere in records connected to the household of Sir Richard de Conn, who went on to marry Richard Barr, one of the ambassadors of King Henry II. I've heard this identification repeated on other podcasts and in pop articles on the Green Children. Duncan Lunan did publish a book in 2012 that presumably lays out his evidence in more detail, but I have not been able to read that. Perhaps it's sound archival research. However, Given that Lunin's theory, setting aside his self-described speculative interpretation that the world the children come from must be another planet that is tidally locked to the sun so that one side is permanently sunlit and boiling and the other ice-cold night, with the inhabitants only able to live in a narrow band in the twilight boundary between the two hemispheres, setting that aside, his Earthbound account of events includes Templar-based conspiracies and other things that leave me a bit skeptical. Also, Clark points out that identifying Richard de Caen of Wykes is no straightforward matter, as both the surname and the name of the manor appear with different spellings. Ultimately, Clark says he accepts the identification of Sir Richard as the Lord of Wykes in Bardwell, a few miles north of Woolpit, where there is documentation of a de Caen family owning property. And this is the Sir Richard that Duncan Lunin investigated. But Clark also notes that earlier writers identified a Richard de Caen of Wakes Colne, just a few miles from Coggeshall Abbey, as Ralph's Sir Richard. So which seems more plausible, that the story comes from a family closer to Woolpit, or that it comes from a family closer to Ralph's own abbey, from whom he might have had occasion to hear this story frequently? Certainly, the details of the narrative itself favors the Woolpit de Caens, because why would the children be taken 20-odd miles away for fosterage? But the circumstances of the story's transmission at least slightly favor the de Caens a few miles further up the road, but near Ralph's own abbey. Which is all just to say, ignoring all of William of Newburgh's warnings, the discourse around the Green Children can fall prey to some false certainties. It's easy to assert we definitely know who Sir Richard was, but it may be murkier than it seems. The dating of the story is another site where this happens, with different authors bending the date range, sometimes by decades, to make it fit their theory. But let's get past the aliens theory first. The one last tidbit here that I want to share is that one of the first direct written references to the story of the Green Children after our medieval authors is in Francis Godwin's The Man in the Moon, or A Discourse of a Voyage Thither by Domingo Gonzalez, written in the late 1620s. In this story, a man travels to the moon and meets its oddly colored inhabitants who have been known to leave their own imperfect children on Earth. Like, the narrator tells us, those green children that William of Newburgh wrote about. So, while Godwin's story is one of our first English examples of science fiction, it's also an early torchbearer for the extraterrestrial theory. Moving on from the paranormal explanations, we have all the various attempts to find a scientifically and historically plausible explanation for this story. Obviously, the main things that require special explanation are why the children are green and where they actually came from. I'll focus on two representative theories, one that's sort of become the classic realistic explanation by Paul Harris from 1998, and a more recent one that's a slight updating of Harris's version by Paul Edward Dutton from 2023. In a nutshell, Harris's theory is that the children were Flemish immigrants, orphaned by a rash of violence against the Flemings that spiked at a couple of points in the 12th century, when there had been, indeed, a major influx of immigrants from Flanders into the south of England, where they were part of the labor force of the wool trade. Harris tries to tie the story to some specific massacres of Flemings, which involves some of the aforementioned date stretching. One such massacre is alleged to have occurred in a village called Fornham St. Martin, only 8 miles from Woolpit. So maybe that's where the children's homeland of St. Martin's Land comes from. However, Clark casts some doubts on the 19th century archaeological evidence for this suspected massacre in Fornham St. Martin. Paul Dutton also goes with the Flemish explanation, but doesn't rely on violence to orphan the children. He points out that William of Newburgh, in his own history, gives us a good reason why Flemish children might wind up lost on their own. William writes, quote, "In the 1154th year from the delivery of the Virgin, Henry, grandson of Henry the Elder by his daughter the late Empress, having arrived in England from Normandy after the demise of King Stephen, received his hereditary kingdom. and, being greeted by all and consecrated king with the holy unction, was hailed throughout England by crowds exclaiming, "Long live the king!" The people, having experienced the misery of the late reign, whence so many evils had originated, now anticipated better things of their new sovereign, more especially as prudence and resolution and a strict regard to justice were apparent in him. And at his very outset he bore the appearance of a great prince. Moreover, he issued an edict that such foreigners as had flocked to England under King Stephen for the sake of booty as well as military service, and especially the Flemings, of whom a vast number at that time burdened the kingdom, should return to their own country by an appointed day, to exceed which would be attended with certain danger. Terrified at this edict, they glided away in a moment, as quickly as a phantom vanishes, while numbers wondered at their instantaneous disappearance. End quote. Dutton proposes that, rather than victims of anti-immigrant violence, the children may simply have become separated from their itinerant father while moving sheep either on a routine trip to market or while heading to port to leave England after Henry II's edict. There is, though, a general issue with explaining the children's mysterious language and clothing by saying they were Flemish immigrants, namely, that it's hard to imagine people in Woolpit not having some familiarity with Flemish people, especially Sir Richard. It's not impossible, but it would be odd that no one would recognize the children's language or cultural markers. But maybe they are simply from a non-supernatural foreign land. Why are they green? Harris and Dutton and most other realistic approaches look for a medical condition to explain it. Harris proposes chlorosis, a form of anemia described in pre-modern and Victorian medical discourse, but no longer diagnosed today. It was said to cause a green coloration of the skin, which is where the chloro in its name comes from, but it was also associated with female virginity, and a commonly suggested cure was to engage in sexual intercourse leading to pregnancy. The modern condition it most resembles is hypochromic anemia, in which the red blood cells have decreased hemoglobin and are thus more pale. It can be hereditary or caused by iron or vitamin B deficiencies. Interestingly, hypochromic anemia has been linked to loss of appetite and aversion to food, which certainly is a tempting tidbit for those seeking to explain the green children as a real occurrence. That said, I've tried to find pictures of patients with hypochromic anemia, and of the very few I've seen that were not obviously enhanced, none display anything I'd call a green complexion, certainly not to an extent that it would be startling to encounter. Much like the exotic Flemish problem, Clark points out that anemia would not exactly be an unheard-of, bizarre condition to the people of Woolpit. Quote, "The green children may well have suffered from iron deficiency and anemia. Many medieval children did. Examination of medieval skeletons has shown traces in the bones left by chronic childhood anemia, probably the result of a poor diet. But Suffolk villagers would surely have recognized the symptoms of anemia, if not the cause. Many of their own children probably suffered from the condition. The green skin of the children found at Woolpit was apparently something far outside local experience. Neither chlorosis, however defined, nor simple iron deficiency anemia can explain it." End quote. Dutton's theory is slightly different, but nicely integrated into the recorded details of the story. Almost too nicely integrated. He explains the green color as a symptom of favism, a hereditary enzyme deficiency. Eating raw broad beans, fava beans, favism, fava beans, a crop known to have been cultivated in Woolpit, eating them can trigger hemolytic anemia in people with this enzyme deficiency, resulting in extreme jaundice as well as hallucinations and dizziness. Also, boys are typically affected more severely than girls. So Dutton envisions these two children becoming lost in the countryside near Woolpit, finding and eating a crop of broad beans, triggering the anemia which gave their skin a greenish pallor and left them disoriented and possibly delusional. The boy is unable to recover and dies. The girl, especially as she expands her diet, gets better. Fauvism would have been a more exotic condition unknown to Woolpit locals. As an inherited condition, it's more commonly found in Britain today among people of Italian, Greek, or Jewish ancestry. That said, the rare enzyme deficiency is still causing essentially the same anemia that malnutrition and other conditions can cause, so it doesn't escape Clark's objection that no pallor brought on by anemia would be so surprising to medieval English folk that it would be called out as a marvel in a story like this, short of at least major snowballing hyperbole in the oral tradition. Looking a little further afield, arsenic poisoning by an evil parent has also been suggested as a reason for a green complexion, and even fabric dye has been proposed, which at least gets us past the implausibility of a vivid green skin tone being produced biologically. The dye theory has its own logistical problems, but it does have at least a tiny bit of support from the original language. Ralph writes that the children viridi colore tingebatur. They were tinged with a green color. The verb there is the passive of tingo, which Lewis and Short define as to soak in color, to dye, color, tinge, but also to baptize, also to wet, moisten, bathe with, or in any liquid. It is also used in contexts where it can mean to paint. In all these usages, tingo refers to some process by which a color or liquid is applied from the outside. Google Translate even gave me dyed green as the translation. Has everyone just been suckered by the less active English descendant of tingo, tinged, where to be tinged can simply mean to possess a quality rather than have a thing done to you? Well, as much as I would love to make a lot of hay out of this, turns out you can find some classical Latin examples of tingo being used to describe the coloration of flowers, for instance. So it was used exactly how we would say something is tinged a certain color. It can mean a color from within, as it were, rather than just one artificially applied. William of Newburgh's phrase is toto corpore virides et coloris insoliti ex incognita materia veste operti. That is, completely green in body and of an unusual color, covered in clothing of an unknown material. I find it interesting that the two key adjectives are both negatives. Insoliti is the negative of solitus, usual, customary, familiar, and incognita negates cognita, known. It is a hallmark of the weird that it is described through negation, by saying what it is not, rather than defining what it is. It helps to retain that aura of mystery and ineffability. With all the argument over just what it means for the green children to be green, I want to wrap up by focusing in on that Latin word, the adjective viridi. Lewis and Short define it as green, though they note that it is used, quote, as the most general designation for every shade of that color, end quote. This word is strongly associated with plant life. It can even be used substantively to mean plants, just like we say greenery or eat your greens in English. But even within the vegetative usage, it can mean greenwood, which isn't particularly vividly green. It's also used to describe the color of the clear sky, which is not part of the spectrum we would usually designate green in English. And yes, this touches on the frequently shared factoid that ancient people couldn't see blue, which is why many ancient languages lack distinct words for blue. This is a myth, based on a misunderstanding of some already questionable science, as well as linguistic history. Short answer, lots of languages draw the categorical boundaries between color labels at different points around the color wheel. And while having a linguistic distinction can help a person recognize a difference between hues faster, it hasn't been shown that a person can't see a difference or perceive a particular hue based on their own vocabulary. The word orange doesn't enter English until the 1400s with the introduction of the fruit, and it isn't used to mean a color until 100 years after that. But that didn't leave Chaucer stumped about how to describe the color of Don Russell the Fox in the Nun's Priest tale. It was, quote, betwixt yellow and red, end quote. Anyway, part of my point is that viridis is not translated simply as green. It can indicate a range of things, a spectrum, you might say. And that's not including its established metaphorical usage. It's also used in classical Latin to mean youthful, fresh, lively, vigorous. I'm not actually suggesting that this whole legend boils down to one person in the chain of transmission mistaking a phrase meaning two youthful children for two green-colored children, but that scenario points to the flexibility of this adjective. Is this truly a vivid, supernatural green like the green of the Green Knight? Or is it a particular light pistachio pallor just within the bounds of realistic biology? Of course, the problem remains for all of the realistic theories that the more plausible you make the appearance of the green children, the less shockingly marvelous the event becomes, which works against the whole reason why people kept telling this story in the first place. The green children can't just be faintly green and still be the green children. For historians trying to make sense of the story of the green children, Dutton provides a fair summation of the problem. Quote, "Given the many deformations potentially at work, the skeptical modern historian might rightly view the story of the green children as, at best, a much corrupted and compromised one, and, at worst, an irrecoverable and useless fantasy now beyond unraveling." End quote. Of course, that didn't stop Dutton from making his own attempt to unravel it. But my little quibble with this characterization would be that I don't think the story is useless even if it can't be unraveled, even if it fundamentally isn't particularly factual. It certainly still gives us useful information about the interests and attitudes of English folk in the 12th century and tells us something about both their and our horizons of credibility. What kinds of claims and details are we ready to accept and with what degree of willingness? Here we have a story that William proclaims to be widely disseminated, though he shows reservations about passing it along in his own history. Ralph leans on the reliability of his allegedly first-hand witness, though it is also worth noting that this isn't a story he includes just in the run of normal events, but is still sequestered into a digression on a number of local marvels and prodigies. While both William and Ralph, as historians, are concerned about the credibility of this story, they are both mostly content to leave its significance unexplained. For them, it is a story full of truth, but without meaning, at least not meaning you could put in a sentence. Whether it is history or not, it is certainly a good story, and maybe only a good story. Just to be a story is why it exists, not to be a message or an explanation or justification or prognostication or anything else. And to tie this 10th anniversary all the way back to a theme we had in episode number 1, this is one place where you can feel the seeds of modern prose fiction, of the modern novel, planted in medieval historiography. And now, it's time for our riddle. This riddle comes from a 17th century manuscript written out likely by children or young adults of the Holm family of Chester, probably in the 1640s. This manuscript is simply a 15-page collection of riddles, some that are similar to ones in other collections we've heard from, and some that appear here for the first time in English sources. While this is not a medieval source, many of these riddles do have old roots, and the editor of the print edition of the book, Frederick Tupper, identifies only 3 known earlier riddle collections in modern English, one of which is the early printed book De Mons Joyeuse from 1511, which we've drawn from before. Here's the riddle. "I have a chapel, all in green. 40 soldiers be therein, and every soldier clothed in white. I'll give ye a groat, and tell me it right." The answer, as supplied in the manuscript, is a pumpion. P-U-M-P-I-A-N. Pumpion, or pompion, is an older form of pumpkin. So we have in our riddle a description of a green gourd filled with white seeds. Pompion comes into English from French, which takes it ultimately from Latin pepon, a word for melon, particularly the species Cucumis mellow, which includes such varieties as honeydew, cantaloupe, and muskmelon, you get to pumpkin by adding the K-I-N suffix over the final syllable of pompion. That suffix is a diminutive, more commonly affixed to personal names like Jenkin and Wilkin and Perkin and Malkin, like the invisible child of Ralph's final story. Somewhat less commonly, it gets attached to nouns like nape, an old word for tablecloth, and if you use the suffix to make that tablecloth smaller, you get a napkin. It's not quite clear why you'd call a pumpkin a little melon. I'm sure modern pumpkins are larger on average than 17th century varieties, which is when the word appears in English, but it still seems a little odd. It's also notable that our 17th century riddle refers to the pompion as being green. I don't know if that reflects early cultivars of pumpkins that were green or pale yellow, or if the word here is referring to a different kind of squash, or if maybe our riddle is actually still referring to a melon. A fun coincidence, the use of the K-I-N suffix comes into England from Flanders and the Low Country. So the Flemish may have given us both the green children and our pumpkins. And that brings us to the end of this episode. I'd like to thank our latest supporters on Patreon. Thank you so much, Will and Paul. And thanks to all the patrons who have supported the show, whether continuously or occasionally or as a one-off. In these 10 years, I haven't really sought to monetize the show. I don't make a living from the show, but your support does mean that I'm able to afford to make the show, and that's not always been a sure thing over this last decade. So again, I just want to say thank you to everyone who has ever helped support the show, including by writing positive reviews and sharing it online. Now, if you do want to join the ranks of those who have offered material support, you can do that at patreon.com/mdtpodcast. If you support the show at any level, you get bonus audio content, including an audiobook and appendix episodes and other goodies. If you'd like to help out by simply spreading the word, our social media accounts are listed and linked on our website, medievaldeathtrip.com, where you can also get bibliographic references for this and every episode, as well as audio for all our episodes, if you have a player app that struggles with large back catalogs. You can also email me there to patrick@medievaldeathtrip.com. I'll admit I've not always been a prompt correspondent, but I will typically get a reply out eventually, often whenever the next episode that's been gnawing at my free time is finally finished and released. So, at 10 years, here's a special sign-off to all our longtime listeners. Until next time, remember not to lick dungeon toads, don't become a grammar teacher, don't jump to conclusions when you find a body in the woods, don't hide a werewolf's clothes, don't overstay your welcome at a monastery, don't let a snake crawl down your throat while you're sleeping, don't try to bargain with a cannibal giant, don't try to impress St. Patrick with your heathen conjurations. Don't try to sail to China in a storm. Don't look a draugr in the eyes. Don't cheat at chess. Don't succumb to incubi. Don't hitch a ride with a frog. Don't try to be the king of the Isle of Man. Don't wear excessively pointy shoes. Don't catch the plague. Don't join up with robber knights. Don't cheat your business partners in the printing press game. Don't make the golem work on the Sabbath. Don't swap jobs with a housewife. And whatever you do, don't eat nothing but beans. And thanks for listening.